Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Issues in 30 Days, Day 2, Mayor Bloomberg as the issue. It's always the case that an incumbent running for re-election is central to a voter's decision. If you're happy with any worker you hire, you're unlikely to shop around for alternatives. It's true with politicians as with plumbers. In Mayor Bloomberg's case, people's strong feelings about everything from no smoking in restaurants to term limits comes into play. So we will spend this full hour on the legacy of Michael Bloomberg to date, with lots of your calls and comments, clips of the mayor, and Joyce Pernick, longtime New York Times Metro reporter, columnist, and Metro section editor, now the author of Michael Bloomberg, The Mogul and the Mayor. Hey, Joyce, congratulations on the book, and thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much, Brian. Delighted to be here.
And let's go right back with an audio clip from 2001 when he's first starting to run for mayor. The public does not know Michael Bloomberg, and he's a little bit awkward. This begins with the voice of New York One reporter Kerry Lyon. This is an excerpt from a New York One story from the time.
New to the stump and the intense media scrutiny, the candidate was at times unsure of himself.
Would it be easier if I just wait for some pictures and get that out of the way?
But at other moments, he exuded the confidence that's made him one of the city's most successful businessmen.
If 4 years from now, reading scores and math scores aren't significantly better, then I will look in a mirror and say that I have been a failure.
So if your book is about the mogul and the mayor, he had to make a transition from mogul to mayor.
Yes, indeed. And it was a somewhat awkward transition. I originally didn't think he could do it. I think a lot of people didn't think he could do it.
And when you go back to the election, it took 9/11, $74 million of his dollars, and some hardball racial politics between Mark Green and the black and Latino communities. Mark Green, the defeated Democrat, who called it the perfect storm, the election
right.
of Mike Bloomberg, which never otherwise would have happened were it not for all these things. How much of Mike Bloomberg's election do you think had to do with Mike Bloomberg?
Well, probably not as much as he would like to think. I think it was a lot of it accidental. It was a fluke. It was 9/11. It was the implosion of the Democrats who really ran Mark ran a terrible campaign, and it was racially polarized. It was Bloomberg's money, which allowed him to take advantage of the situation, and it was Giuliani, who, as you may remember, endorsed Bloomberg, and that helped Bloomberg a lot. All of those things came together, and then he still only won by 2 percentage points. It was not a big win.
Right. Mm-hmm. People forget, because then he cruised in 2005.
Right.
Listeners, you're going to be a big part of this hour. After 8 years of Mayor Bloomberg, what are the essential points of his legacy? I'm going to ask Joyce to help me build a legacy list here in a minute. But what are the essential points of Michael Bloomberg's 8 years in office to you? And what are the best things and the worst things he's ever done? How about calling up with the best two things and the worst two things that you think Mayor Bloomberg has done in office? 212-433-WNYC 433-9692 or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And if you're undecided in the race, because after all, we're doing this in the context of an election series, how much is your ambivalence about him the central issue in this race? 212-433-WNYC 433-9692 or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Joyce, you're right about some ways in which Bloomberg had entered office trying to be not Giuliani on matters of race in particular and on some matters of culture. One of his first acts after the election was to call the Reverend Al Sharpton.
That's right. And I was thinking of the issue you just raised, what are some of the best things that he's done. I think to calm racial tensions in this city, which had become very polarized under Giuliani, I would argue a little bit with Giuliani's help. And Bloomberg made a very conscious decision. I heard this from his advisors. I heard it from Al Sharpton. I heard it from Bloomberg. He made a conscious decision to change that, to reach out to Sharpton. He called him. It was either the night before the election or right after he won. Nobody can remember. Bloomberg couldn't remember. Sharpton said it was right after he won, and he got it early in the morning when he was driving back to his apartment. And he was in the. He said he had a very sharp memory of being Sharpton of being in the car and getting a cell phone call. But in any case,
it's a small detail, but it does it have a different meaning if he calls him before the election or after the election?
Well, I think only slightly, because he had been reaching out to blacks and Hispanics mm-hmm. before the election, and he continued to do so afterwards. So I don't think it has had an enormous impact. And then Bloomberg, when he was mayor-elect, he was going, I think he was mayor-elect, he was going to an event of the 100 black men. And somebody said, well, you can't, someone on his staff said, well, you can't arrive at such and such an hour, because if you do, you run into Sharpton and there'll be a big picture and you'll be in trouble with the New York Post. And Bloomberg basically said, that's exactly what I'm going to do. And he picks up the phone and he calls Sharpton. He says, are you going to the 100 black men in Sharpton? Yeah, I'll be there. Bloomberg says, I can't go to the dinner, but I'm going to the reception before the cocktail party. I'll meet you there.
He was happy to have the photo op.
He wanted the photo op. He wanted to get it over with. And as he said, I got one, Bloomberg said, I got one photograph on the front page of the New York Post with a headline and a bad editorial, and it was over. And then much more quietly, he reached out to a lot of African-American leaders and Latino leaders and basically let them know that he wanted to change the climate. And this was appreciated and I think had an impact when things went bad occasionally, as
and
they
you
do
write
in this town.
That in interviewing his potential corporation counsel, that would be the city's top lawyer.
Oh, I love that story.
Bloomberg wanted him to know that the head of Lincoln Center, Nat Leventhal, didn't stand up to Giuliani on the Brooklyn Museum. Now, unpack that for us.
Yeah.
The Brooklyn Museum incident again was, because this happened a long time ago.
Okay, yes. What happened was that there was I don't want to call it a painting, well, maybe it was a painting by an artist named Ophelia, as I remember, which had some African elephant dung on it, and it was a whole series of artworks. That's right.
Using dung in artistic ways in the images.
And the one that Giuliani objected to had the image of the Virgin Mary, and Giuliani was infuriated, and he made an attempt, which was unsuccessful, to cut off city funds to the Brooklyn Museum. So now that took place, I think, in Giuliani's next to last year, maybe his last year in office. I can't remember. When he was running for office, Bloomberg was asked about that, and he said, I leave art to the artists and the museums. I don't want anything to do with that. He's now interviewing, he's mayor-elect, he's interviewing Michael Cardozo to be corporation counsel. And he asks Cardozo what Cardozo would do if he, Bloomberg, who was going to stay in his townhouse rather than move to Gracie Mansion, decided to clear out a bunch of trees in Central Park to build a heliport so that he could fly into Central Park, which was, of course, a trick question. Didn't mean it seriously, and Cardozo's no fool. He knew he didn't mean it seriously, but he knew that there was a reason Bloomberg was asking the question. Present at this interview was Nat Leventhal, who's the former head of president of Lincoln Center. And when Leventhal was the president of Lincoln Center, and he was hoping for some city money from Giuliani for a rebuilding effort, when the heads of other cultural institutions signed a petition opposing Giuliani's effort to cut off city funds to the Brooklyn Museum, Nat Leventhal did not sign it. So, all right, we're back in the Cardozo interview. Bloomberg says to Cardozo, well, what would you do? Would you represent me if in fact, I was sued over my heliport in Central Park? And he said, it would depend. He said, you know, under the law, you don't represent someone in a frivolous lawsuit. And he said, you wouldn't represent me? He said, well, I'd have to think about it, something to that effect. And then that's when Bloomberg turned to Nat Leventhal and he said, why didn't you stand up to Giuliani on the Brooklyn Museum? And so he was sending a message to Cardozo, be independent. I thought that was really interesting.
And that the culture wars were not going to be the same under Bloomberg as
Absolutely.
Under Giuliani.
And they haven't been.
And maybe that a certain authoritarian governing style wouldn't be the same. Although you compare Bloomberg to Murdoch in the book, and you say in a different way he's got his own autocratic tendencies.
I also compare him to Giuliani in some ways. I think that he in many ways he is autocratic. He wants to control his environment. He feels very strongly about things. But he does it in a more benign and less confrontational way, so that compared with Giuliani, he doesn't seem as combative. He's not as combative.
Bob in Rego Park, you're on WNYC with Joyce Pernick, author of Mike Bloomberg, Money, Power, Politics. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Brian. How are you today?
I'm doing great. So did you call with the best and the worst thing of the Bloomberg
yes,
year
I
so
did.
Far?
First, I want to say that I think you're terrific. I wish you were running for mayor. That's the first thing.
That's I'm not in that business.
I know.
Thank you, though.
Well, the best thing I would say is the educational system has improved. And the police, the safety of the citizens is fantastic since Bloomberg. I just want to say I voted for Mr. Bloomberg. I absolutely will not be voting for him. And the specific thing that reason why I won't be voting for him is I'm a middle-class person, approximately $60,000. I own a house. My taxes on my house since 96 has gone up almost 80%, believe it or not, from $1,700 to $4,000. It's obviously outrageous, and there's a specific issue I just mentioned about the 6.3% that I pay to the state of New York. Someone in New York pays, who makes $600,000, also 6.3%. Bloomberg knows that. He doesn't mention it. He's really just interested in protecting his rich friends.
Bob, I'm gonna leave it there. Thank you very much. Please call us again. And so, Joyce, best for Bob in Rego Park, public safety, worst, property taxes.
Public safety and education, worse property
yes.
taxes. That's and then he says he won't vote for him. That's even though he
right.
praises
it. Actually,
really
wait a minute. Bob, are you still there?
Yes, sir.
You think Bill Thompson's going to lower your taxes more than Michael Bloomberg?
Absolutely. I think he's going to deal with that issue and go after, which there's no problem with people making money, but you can't have someone who makes $600,000 not contributing when he should be contributing. The people who make the money and the regular people will even if it stays the same, which I'm not too happy about, but use the money instead of getting rid of teachers in schools, instead of not finding communities such as Rockaway and many communities that you could say, hey, we got all this money. Let's put these people to work. You're a high school graduate. Let's give you a legitimate job. There's so many positive things that can be done.
What do you think he is using the money for?
Absolutely. For enriching his rich
wow.
friends.
You think so? All right, Bob, thank you. Now, that might go to the development issue.
Yeah.
Which we're going to do a whole week on in our 30 Issues in 30 Days mm-hmm. series. We're going to do a full week because we think it's so central to our listeners' concerns.
It's a huge issue.
The feedback that we get. Yeah. A week on New York development next week and a week on New Jersey development issues mm-hmm. relevant to the governor's race.
Let me speak a little more generally, if I may, to Bob's point. I obviously cannot address his own property taxes. I don't know if he had a reassessment. I don't know the reason his property taxes went up so dramatically.
But there was a property tax increase in the mayor's first year when he had our first recession under his watch.
Exactly. And then he plugged in a rebate when he was approaching, remember, when he was approaching reelection in 2005. Overall, Michael Bloomberg made a decision, which you can agree with or not agree with, but he made a decision not to cut essential services after when he became mayor and we're in the post 9/11 period. And he said, I'm going to raise taxes. Everyone remembers this. The property taxes went up dramatically. I'm going to raise taxes rather than cut city services. I'm going to raise taxes rather than risk crime going up because we have to cut the police force, although he has, but not as much, presumably, as he would have if taxes had not gone up. He made that decision. He said, I'm going to protect crime, policing, I'm going to protect schools. And that's going to take money because we're in the end of a recession and the impact of 9/11. He made that choice, and that's the reason that property taxes went up, and he said so at the time. And then once the economy started to rebound, he was able to give back some of it in a rebate. But that was a clear philosophical decision.
From our comments page, listener writes, it's important to separate Bloomberg's personal image, arrogant, money coming out of his ears, rich, from what he has done to make life better, healthier, and more fun for all New Yorkers. 311, biking, extended New York public library hours, smoking ban. And we'll continue with Joyce Pernick in a minute. Her new book, Mike Bloomberg, Money, Power, Politics, as we talk about the mayor himself as an issue in his race. day two of our election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days. And when we come back, Joyce, I want to focus on a major theme of your book, which is the relationship between Bloomberg the mayor and Bloomberg the billionaire in terms of how he spreads his wealth around, perhaps for political purposes. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We will be doing our show this Friday in our WNYC performance space, the Jerome L. Green performance space, and we have a limited number of tickets for sale. It's the 20th anniversary of this program, and we will have a 20-year news and history quiz for you to participate in and even win some WNYC goodies if you can answer three questions in a row correctly, just like when we do it on the phone. We'll also have Michael Moore on with us via video feed to talk about his new movie, Capitalism, A Love Story, and screen some clips with us. I saw the movie last night. It is amazing. And he will reflect on the 20th anniversary of his debut film, Roger and Me. And Michael Moore will take questions from our audience at the Green Space. So it should be fun with Michael Moore and the news quiz and the giveaways. Again, it's this Friday morning, live at 10 a.m. in our Jerome L. Green performance space. Tickets are just $10, and we have only about 50 seats available. So if you want to come, go to wnyc.org/thegreenspace right now to be in the audience for our show this Friday morning, wnyc.org/thegreenspace. And green has an E at the end of it, and I hope to see you there. We continue with Joyce Pernick, New York Times, Metro Matters columnist, former Metro Section editor, longtime Metro reporter, and her new book, Mike Bloomberg, Money, Power, Politics, as we look at the mayor as an issue himself in his reelection, issue two in our 30 Issues in 30 Days series. I want to set up a clip of an interview that I did with the mayor in 2007. I was on a little panel with him. It was a breakfast event with Greg David from Crain's New York Business. And this is a little exchange that we had on the question of political parties and his independence. And I asked him if, having broken with the Republicans, if he could point out any significant difference between what he stands for and the Democrats.
I don't agree with your fundamental premise. I don't think that I disagree with what any national party stands for, because I don't think that either national party stands for anything. I think the people in those parties stand for things. There isn't any philosophy for a party. When's the last time you saw the platform of either party be tracked out and say, oh, we said 3 years ago at our convention, this is what we stand for? Come on, get serious. That's just to give you something to write about in the middle of a boring convention. There's nothing else. There are people from the far left to the far right in both parties. There are people who I agree with on all of these issues, social issues that you mentioned, and on international issues. And if you want to find somebody in the party that you disagree with, easy to do. You want to find somebody you agree with, easy to do.
Mayor Bloomberg. With me, 2007, The parties don't stand for anything.
Right, right. We actually had this discussion. He got just as heated, if not more so, with me as he did with you. And I finally said to him, what about the Supreme Court? I mean, I have to say, Joyce Pernick, I'm a registered independent, and I'm not a partisan. But it does seem to me that there are provable differences between the parties, more and more so. And so I raised the question with him. He answered, as I said, as he answered you. And then I said, what about the Supreme Court? And I said, if you look back in the last few appointments, do you really think that this was when Bush was president. Do you really think that there's no difference between the parties? And he fumbled a little bit, and then he said, well, you never really know where anyone stands on anything anyway, and they can get on the Supreme Court and change their minds. And so I didn't know where to go. He really does believe that, and I don't think it's demonstrably provable, but that's what he believes, that there's no difference between the parties.
Best and worst of Mayor Bloomberg, Josie in Morningside Heights. Hi, Josie.
Hi. I'm basically a supporter of the mayor's, but the one thing that really troubled me, that has troubled me during his terms has been the development of real estate that seemed to be, before the financial crisis hit, seemed to be really unbridled and didn't seem to take into account the impact on the residents of the city. Now, obviously, the financial crisis changed that a lot, but as things get better over time, I'm wondering where he's going to come down on all of that again.
Right. Good question. And as I said, we're going to do a full week on development in New York City as an issue in the race next week. But, Joyce, in your book, you said that the massive rezoning of the city is one of Bloomberg's biggest legacies.
Absolutely.
18 different, is that the number? 18 different neighborhoods rezoned.
At the time, you know.
When you wrote the book, maybe now it's 23. Mm-hmm. For what? What does the rezoning do?
Well, what the rezoning does is it, most of it, I mean, there are different kinds of rezonings, and some of them are not neighborhoods, some of them are little patches. But what they allow for a different kind of use for the area. The best example, of course, is the west side of Manhattan, where he wanted to put a stadium. And that was zoned basically manufacturing and industrial. We don't have as much manufacturing. We don't have as much industrial. We have less and less and less of it. So the question was, could it be rezoned to allow for basically residential housing and commercial? Otherwise, you could not build up those areas. And that's been true in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, for example. All throughout the city, areas that were changing how they could be used but couldn't really go all the way because the zoning didn't allow it, the zoning then was changed to permit the changed use of the areas. It's sort of a complicated concept. But let me just say, there is no question, and he would be the first to say it, that Mike Bloomberg is pro-development. I mean,
and what you wrote in the book is that he sees development as a developer would see it, not as an urban planner would see it.
Precisely.
That's an important line.
Precisely. He is a businessman. He looks at the bottom line. I said to him, so much development. When do you say it's overdevelopment? It was my question to him. And his answer was something to the effect of, and with a typical, wasn't too happy to answer, so I guess I shouldn't characterize it, but he wasn't too happy. And he said, how do you think we pay the teachers? Where do you think we get that money from? As he sees it, it's cause and effect. You want to pay, you hire more teachers, you want to improve the schools, you got to pay for it. How are you going to pay for it? It's going to be taxation, and it's going to be letting developers develop. That is how he sees it, and pay taxes.
Josie, you still there?
On that, if it's possible, is at what point does it start pushing the middle class out of the city to the degree that it doesn't even matter who's paying for the teachers
anymore?
Well,
he would say more and more housing being built with, 421A rules or 80-20 rules for affordable housing. And if we're going to have a million more people by 2030, as he projects, we need building to make housing reasonably affordable in New York City. He would say.
That's
Josie.
Right. He would. Let me also say that, and Brian, you know this is an evergreen in New York. This is a perennial. It goes, I do not remember a mayor. I have covered, I guess it's six mayors. I do not remember a mayor who was not challenged on this issue.
Or a development project that the neighbors liked.
Right, exactly. I mean, every mayor I can think of has been charged with being pro-development and with being pro-developer and getting campaign contributions, which, of course, is not the issue with Bloomberg, but still. So, I mean, it's a forever question.
You talk about the campaign, and Josie, thank you. Talk about the campaign contributions. I want to take a few minutes and explore this. My guest, Joyce Pernick, her new book, Mike Bloomberg, Money, Power, Politics. I see a major theme of your book as the relationship between Bloomberg the mayor and Bloomberg the billionaire. You have a chapter explicitly on it, and it comes up elsewhere. He has never needed campaign donations, which has helped him be as independent as he is and say what he wants about the political parties. But he stands the issue on its head by giving so much money to constituent groups that he may need in other ways, to the New York State Republican Party and the Independence Party. Instead of taking money from the parties, as most politicians do, he gives money to the political parties. He gives to various cultural organizations. So let's do some of the who before why here. Who has Bloomberg given money to that could be deemed a reverse campaign donation?
You want to ask it the other way? Who hasn't he given? It truly is a very long list, and a lot of it goes through the Carnegie Corporation, and it was originally anonymous, but within about 3 minutes, It's only a slight exaggeration there. Everybody knew that it was Bloomberg's money, and it began after 9/11, and it originally went to cultural institutions in the city that had been hurt in the post-9/11 climate, and only cultural institutions. And then as time went on, the Carnegie money grew, and it included civic groups, many, many civic groups, many of them totally non-political, if not most of them non-political, except you have to look at the impact. And that's one of the questions I raise. What is the impact in terms of seeding goodwill? It's very, very positive. At the same time, it's a good thing. And so people have very conflicted feelings about this.
You have an extraordinary quote in the book from David Jones of the Community Service Society, many time guest on this show. That's the think tank, the Community Service Society, an advocacy group for the poor. David Jones, very committed to those issues. And Bloomberg gives them money. And Jones admits to you that when he wrote an op-ed critical of the mayor on, what was it, a housing policy, mm-hmm. he pulled his punches.
Right.
That's very candid of David Jones.
Yeah. He said, you know, I probably would have been a little angry in tone in the piece. He said, I wrote it.
I wrote a critical piece.
He said, but I said, do you think other people are chilled to the effect that they wouldn't write it at all? He said, yes. He said, I thought the line that, in fact, the line you probably were, a quote you were referring to, as he said, with a laugh, I got my bribe. He got his money. When I was working on that chapter, I decided to make a cold call to a few different organizations, people I didn't know at all, just picked from the Carnegie list. And I decided,
not-for-profits, cultural institutions. Social service institutions.
Correct. I called a few just randomly and asked for the executive director. One of them was the Paper Bag Players, which got, I don't remember how much, not a lot of money. But to these small institutions, 5,000 or 10,000, which is small to us, I mean to most in the city, it's not a lot of money. It can mean the difference between paying your electric bill and not paying. And the guy that I spoke to there, I introduced myself, I said what I was doing and explained I would like to know how we felt about getting this money from the Carnegie Corporation. And if he knew it was Bloomberg, he said, oh, yes, of course, he said. We love him. We love him for it.
So what's the downside? I'm glad the paper bag players get that money.
Well, there is. That's why it's complicated. There is no downside in that sense, except nobody else can do that. And so the playing field, no other public figure can do that.
Well, there are implications for loyalty when it comes to reelection time.
Right.
Are there implications for public policy?
There are implications for support, for the way he makes public policy,
or for how it turns out.
I think there are the implications when he was pushing for a change in the term limits law. Some of the more high profile people who got Bloomberg money testified at the city council in favor of extending term limits. They say, and I duly report in my book, that they would have done so anyway. Would they have? And did that have an impact on the vote? Those are the kinds of questions, Brian, that this raises. It's really quite fascinating. And let me add that the money is not only from Carnegie. Some of it comes directly from Bloomberg or from his foundation. And so to sort of get a comprehensive list is difficult.
And one other thing on that then, because you wrote something in the book that I didn't know, which is that the beneficiaries of his largesse are selected in consultation with his deputy mayor, Patricia
mm-hmm.
Harris.
Mm-hmm.
But she's a public official.
Right.
Helping determine where his private charity goes?
That's right. She actually is also his chief advisor on all of his charitable giving. That was her job at Bloomberg LP. She's a deputy mayor. I mean, it raises questions. Now, it comes down to what the public's view is of his honesty, and it also, which I think people do believe he's honest and that she's honest. And I think it also comes down to comparing that, as Richard Emery does in the book. He's a civil libertarian and the lawyer who led the lawsuit. Remember that got rid of the Board of Estimate. You compare that with a mayor or someone running for mayor who gets a lot of money from a special interest, from a union or from a developer. How do you square that circle? It's a fascinating conundrum. It really is.
Joyce Pernick, author of Mike Bloomberg, Money, Power, Politics, my guest on WNYC. We're asking our listeners the best and the worst of 8 years to date of Michael Bloomberg. Gene, on our comments page, the best smoking ban. Our listeners seem to love the smoking ban. I guess that's not controversial anymore. It was so controversial.
You know, that I loved that researching that section of the book, because at the time, you would have thought that every restaurant in the city would close. The bar business and some of the restaurateurs were furious, and they were lobbying against
our lines were 50-50. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of things our callers are not 50-50 on. I mean, we just opened the phones and said, go, and half the callers said, this is the greatest thing. Oh, my God, this is so good. How could he do this? He's not everything, you know.
Yeah, and what he was doing, of course, was building on Koch actually began this. He banned smoking in public buildings. You may remember that. But he was not able to ban smoking in parts of restaurants. Remember, we had these non-smoking
buildings, sections,
and the smoke would waft over, and I know I would get a headache.
Like the airplanes.
And the people who worked in the restaurants were exposed to it. And Tom Frieden, who was the health commissioner, brought this to Bloomberg, and he said, go for it. And Bloomberg is a reformed smoker, which might explain it a little bit.
But it's not even controversial anymore.
Not at all. Not at all.
Okay. So best, says Gene on our comments page, smoking ban, attempts to control vehicles in the city, fiscal management, sober, competent style after all the usual New York City clowns. So that's a lot of good stuff from Gene.
Yeah.
Worst, term limits, evasion, even though I believe a two-term limit gives ultimate power to the special interest, vulnerable staffs and lobbyists. So the way he evaded the term limits, and let's listen to the mayor speaking about that.
I've listened to people all across the city, and the vast majority have expressed their support. There are certainly some who are not in favor, and they've been strong in expressing their views, and that's what democracy is all about.
Now, you have an interesting section about term limits, or at least a speculation, which is that he may have let himself down according to his own values.
Right.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
What section of the book?
Yeah, of course I do.
Talk about that.
Yeah. I think that the way he went about knocking down the term limits law really did severe damage to his own image and self-image as being above politics, above the fray, better than the usual politics as usual pal in New York City, because he really had to play hardball politics to get it done in the city council. He chose to do that rather than go the referendum route, pretty clearly, as in my view, because he had a poll that he took in June which showed he wouldn't win a referendum, and he told people that I'm not going to win a referendum. If they did the referendum in November, which was the same time as the presidential race, which would have gotten a very large turnout. And some of his closest friends, whom I spoke to, said they thought that some of his displays of temper that we saw in the fall and going into the winter of 2008 might have been Bloomberg being angry at himself, which is kind of an interesting little psychological analysis.
Psychoanalytic speculation. But here's – because he never betrays it in public when he talks about term limits. He's gotten very defensive with Ozzie Pabra from the New York Observer when he raised the question in a legitimate journalistic way. He was just on to talk about that. Here is the mayor with a New York Post reporter.
If the economy is turning around – as you said, does that mean that the rationale for extending term limits, which was the fiscal challenge?
Why don't you just get serious questions here?
But the question is...
The rationale for extending term limits is the city council voted it, and the public's going to have a chance on November 3rd to say what they want. And I don't think we have to keep coming back to that. When you have a serious question about the economy, I'd be happy to answer it. Anything else? Thank you very much. Nothing else?
And actually, my apologies, that was the exchange with Ozzie Pabra from the New York Observer.
Right.
But despite that, you think he may be ambivalent about his own action, which would mean that he wants power so much.
Well, he didn't want to leave the stage. Look, he loves it. He loves what he's doing. He wanted to be president. It didn't work. Was he going to disappear into an East Side townhouse and write checks through his foundation, which is what he originally said he was going to do, and no longer be on the public stage, no longer go to the some event in Washington where the president pokes fun at him and he gets all this attention for his money and for his grandstanding? I mean, he loves this stuff. He's listened to on gun control, or illegal guns, as he would call it. He's invited to climate change conferences. He goes all over the world. It's because he's mayor of New York. It's not because he's a multibillionaire.
Joyce Pernick, formerly of the New York Times, now the author of Mike Bloomberg, Money, Power, Politics, the Mayor Himself, as issue two in our 30 Issues in 30 Days New York, New Jersey election series. We'll come back in a minute, and we have compiled 11 clips of Mayor Bloomberg from his two terms, and we will see how many of them this expert, this person who has meticulously researched the 8 years of the Bloomberg administration, can identify the context of. The Joyce Pernick Mayor Bloomberg quiz coming up in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Joyce Pernick, author of Mike Bloomberg, Money, Power, Politics. And okay, as promised, the Joyce Pernick, Michael Bloomberg quiz. And you can play along at home or in your car or listening on your iPod or wherever you are right now. Okay, so the basic question is, what's the what's the context here? Let's see. Okay, here's – all right, the first clip is only 5 seconds.
I'm going to get the little SOB next year, though. I'm going to bite him in front of the camera.
Okay, wasn't talking about Bill Thompson. I'll give you that.
No, I have no idea.
You don't know. That was, we're starting on the lighter end of things. Speaking on his WOR radio show, vowing to take revenge on Staten Island Chuck, the groundhog who bit him.
Oh, of course, of course, of course.
On yes. Groundhog's Day of this year. He says, I'm going to get that little SOB. Bite him back. Mm-hmm. All right. Here's another one.
I think that it is a battle that we will win. I think it is a great public service. If we do it, maybe others will follow, as they have in other public health initiatives that we've taken in our city.
All right. Now, it wasn't smoking. What might it be?
Trans fats or salt, one of the two.
This was actually the calorie counts.
Yeah, the trans fats, calorie count, they came together, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, that was another innovative thing with respect to public health, one of his great passions.
Absolutely. And in each case, this is really interesting, Brian, in each case where he's tried to reform public nutrition and eating habits, it's because he had a personal connection to it. He was a smoker. He was a chain smoker when he was younger. He stopped when he was in his 30s. He talks quite openly about having a constant battle with weight. And I have never met anyone who consumes the level of salt that this guy does. I just have to share this briefly. I was at Gracie Mansion one day for an interview with him for this book. And there was a big bowl of popcorn. He loves popcorn. He said, would you like some popcorn? Well, I like popcorn too. So I took a small handful and I put some in my mouth, and my lips burned. Not only was it so salty that I couldn't tolerate it, but there was a salt shaker on the tray, and he added more salt to it. So everything that has interested him and he's tried to impose in terms of public health, or many of them in the city, are things that he has a problem with. Interesting.
That is interesting. And speaking of fast food establishments,
we are going and reinspecting any place that particular investigator inspected.
We are inspecting all of the places that that particular restaurant owner has.
Remember that?
Yes. That had to be the rats, right? And the one of the chain restaurants.
The rats and the KFC in the village.
Yep. That was some image, right?
All right. Then let's go on to another one, the Joyce Pernick Mayor Bloomberg quiz.
We have to have a debate. We have to have a vote. We have to let people or force people, particularly elected officials, to stand up and say explicitly on the record where they stand.
Well, that could be anything.
That's too general.
Too general. I'll give you a break on that one. But that happened to be April 16th of this year, coming out forcefully in support of Albany taking up a gay marriage proposal.
Ah, okay.
New stand for him? Something he evolved on over the years?
He did evolve on that. He was always pro-gay rights, but he took a position earlier on that I think he said it had to be legislated as opposed to I can't remember the details,
yes,
but took an ambiguous position, and then he took a stronger overt position, I have to say, when he was running for re-election. But
this is a tangent, we'll get back to these clips, but he took an ambiguous position on the Iraq war I interviewed him one time, and I don't think he ever came out really for or against the war.
Well, he didn't take much of it. I was about to say, he didn't take much of a position on it at all. It always puzzled me that here's a guy who wanted to run for president, and he didn't really get a strong sense of where he stood on that at that point, issue.
And yet you wrote in the book that the mayor who does not sit through many movies beginning to end loved and watched the whole entirety of Charlie Wilson's War.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
About Afghanistan.
That was fascinating. About Afghanistan. But the connection he made to the movie was that at one point in the movie, which, as you may remember, starred Tom Hanks, Charlie Wilson wants to get, after spending tons of the congressman, tons of money in Afghanistan on covert ops and so on, then Charlie Wilson wanted to get a relatively modest sum of money for schools in Afghanistan, and Congress would not give him the money. And this deeply offended Bloomberg. I find it interesting that so far your listeners have barely raised education in there. That's kind of interesting. I guess a few have, but other issues seem to top the list of the issues that they think he has done the best with.
I think our listeners are burnt out on talking about Mayor Bloomberg and education,
okay,
because
right,
we did so much on that during the mayoral control of schools reenactment debate. Ellen in Brooklyn, however, just wrote on our website a little while ago, best thing, education, more choice of schools for families, more control for principals. Worst, education, corrosive emphasis on test scores, teaching to the test.
Yeah.
So interesting ambivalence.
The story, in my view, I don't think that the story of education under Bloomberg is completed yet. I don't think we really know what the long-term effect will be. I do believe, based on some intensive study of the statistics and interviews, that the schools have gotten better, and the promise of schools getting better is extraordinary compared to where it was. But I don't think they have gotten have improved as much as he and his people say they have.
That's Joyce Pernick, author of Mike Bloomberg, Money, Power, Politics. And we're playing some audio bites from various moments in the Bloomberg administration. Steve Joyce, who's done this whole book on the mayor, recognizes them. Here is what the mayor said right after a very intense incident.
And I said to the fiancée, look, nothing anybody can ever say can bring back the man that you were in love with. We've just got to build and make things better. And she said to me, yes, and make sure it doesn't happen again. And I said, yes, that's exactly what we have to do.
Whose fiancée?
Yeah, I'm drawing
a
blank.
And that was to Sean Bell's fiancée.
Oh, of course. That was an enormous incident in this city. And that, by the way, is one of the tragedies that I point to where I believe the city benefited from Bloomberg reaching out to Sharpton and other members of the African American community, so that when there was that, this was the the police shooting of Sean Bell, who was celebrating his impending marriage at a bar one night of his bachelor party, and he was unarmed and he was shot and killed by police. And it didn't blow up. People were angry and upset, but it didn't blow up, and I think in part that was because of the trust that Bloomberg had been able to very, very overtly chose to establish some trust with black leaders.
Here's another clip from another moment in his administration. And one of the things that we haven't gotten to yet that I really should mention, that a lot of our listeners are writing in as the worst thing in his administration, is relevant to this clip.
And that's why the NYPD, in accordance with court-approved guidelines, monitored those who said they intended to use vandalism or worse, to disrupt our wonderful city, including shutting down Wall Street and trashing targeted businesses.
Got it?
Are we talking about the stop and frisk policies?
No, we're talking about the Republican convention.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And, you know, I to this day wonder why the mayor, who valued his political independence, I know he wanted both conventions to come in 2004. He made a pitch to the Democrats. He made a pitch to the Republicans, as I understood it at the time. But it so happened that it was the Republican convention. He appeared. This appeared to many to be endorsing Bush and Cheney at the very low point of what was going on in Iraq, what was being revealed about detainees. And there he was, side by side.
Yeah.
Not to mention the sweeps by the NYPD.
Well, it was at the time he was a Republican, at the time the city was still recovering, coming back from 9/11. He wanted to show the city was safe and a fun place or whatever, and I guess that would be the rationale. And it was the police conduct and the criticism and the subsequent lawsuits that clip referred to, and quite interestingly, you'll see in the book, he makes a very strong defense, even though most of these lawsuits were settled in favor of the plaintiffs, and it cost the city a fortune in settlements. But he still defends it. Basically, he would say, people didn't want to get arrested. They shouldn't have been out there. That's basically what he said.
So what have we left out? I think we've compiled a pretty good list of the mayor's chief legacy items here. This hour, public school reforms, massive development, 311, no smoking in restaurants, suspending term limits, failure on the West Side Stadium, and congestion pricing.
I think we haven't done much on congestion pricing. We didn't talk much about the stadium. And he had some major failures, and those were two of them. And three of them, if you include the Olympics. Some of his more high-profile initiatives sort of died when they came up against
Shelley Silver
and the powers of Albany.
One more quiz question. You remember this?
You see, I don't take very good tests.
This is not the most significant moment of his administration. I'll give you that clue.
After some lab tests, we conclusively identified the odor as an ester, a harmless chemical compound created by a reaction between alcohol and an acid, and alcohol and an acid. In this case, the ester was the result of the manufacturing of fragrances and food flavors based on the fenugreek seed.
Ester who?
That was when people in parts of Manhattan were complaining about this overly sweet odor. This terrible sweet smell that was wafting over from somewhere, and it turned out to be from it was a factory right in New Jersey that was making something or other.
And that's right.
Used esters. Right?
And the mayor got to announce what the fenugreek derivative actually was. All right, so we have 45 seconds. Mm-hmm. This was not about the race. This is our 30 Issues in 30 Days series. Right. This is about the mayor's record. Thank you for doing such a wonderful job. How do you run against all this if you're Bill Thompson?
Well, he's running on the theme that eight is enough, and he's running on the mayor's third term strategy, and he's trying to portray him as a self-interested, moneyed guy, and he is all of those things. And I think Bloomberg's personality will play something of a role in the race, but I think Thompson is going to have a really tough time.
Joyce Pernick, her book, Mike Bloomberg, Money, Power, Politics. thank you so much.
Delighted to be here.
Issue 2 in our fall New Jersey, New York election series, 30 issues in 30 days. Tomorrow we will do issue 3, and that will be on urban policy, Newark and other cities as an issue in the New Jersey governor's race. Now, we will be doing our show this Friday in our WNYC performance space, and I want you to know that we're inviting you, and we have a limited number of tickets for sale. It's the 20th anniversary of this program, and we'll have a 20-year news and history quiz for you to participate in and win some WNYC souvenirs if you can answer 3 questions in a row correctly, just like we do when you call up to take our history and news quizzes on the phone. We will also have Michael Moore on with us via video feed to talk about his new movie, Capitalism, A Love Story, and screen some clips with us and reflect on the 20th anniversary of his debut film, Roger and Me. And Michael Moore will take questions from our audience in the green space. So it should be fun with Michael Moore and the contest and the giveaways. Again, it's this Friday morning, live at 10 a.m. in our Jerome L. Green performance space. Tickets are just $10, and we only have about 50 seats available as of when we went on the air this morning. So if you want to come, go to wnyc.org/thegreenspace to be in the audience for our show this Friday morning, wnyc.org/thegreenspace, and green has an E at the end of it. Lisa Allison, Jody Evergan, and Paige Cowett produced this program. We had intern help from Tala Al-Husri, and our senior producer is Megan Ryan. That's Debbie Fountain at the audio controls. Talk to you tomorrow. I'm Brian Lehrer.